go is go.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Mysterioso here for May 16th of 2010. We promised last week and we are going to deliver. This week we're going to talk about, in particular, the Belgian Triangle, or at least the UFO Flying Triangle.
We're sorry. Your deal, call did not go
problem,
through.
Conundrum. In the meantime, I will introduce our guest, one of them anyway. And it's a guy I've known for a while, John Shirley. John Shirley is known mainly as an author, but he's probably known best as the original screenwriter for The Crow, the 1994 film.
Really? Well, we might have to really do them one at a time. John Shirley is an author. He's probably best known as the original screenwriter for The Crow, the 1994 film with, who was in that, John? Brandon Lee. Yeah. And he's been writing horror and science fiction for about 30 years, I think, right?
Yeah.
With novels like
Suspense and Crime.
Yes. With the Eclipse Trilogy, Wet Bones, and a 1998 short story collection called Black Butterflies, which won the Bram Stoker Award from the Horror Writers of America, and a Best Books Award or Citation, or what is it called, John?
From Publishers Weekly.
Yeah.
From the Bram Stoker's, the Horror Writers of America, the Bram Stoker Award.
Right. Which is a fairly well-known award. I've known John for about 15 years, maybe a little bit more. Right? Something like that. Didn't we meet in like 95 or something?
Yes, I believe that is correct, sir.
Yeah. And I believe you may have even based one of the characters, a minor character in Silicon Embrace, on me, or at least a composite of me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a...
Silicon Embrace is a novel, John. That involved flying saucers. I mean, it's a... Yeah. And, I had to throw in a UFO investigator, and I modeled one somewhat on you, and Yeah. And there's probably even a fraction of you in my novel, The Other End, which may become a movie pretty soon.
Oh, excellent. That's the only way you make money.
Which is an alternative novel about the end of the world. It's like the alternative version of the end of the world, The Other End. It's the end of the world for progressive people. You know, it's to contradict the right-wing Christian left behind end of the world.
Right.
It's the judgment day for liberals. That is, by liberals. Envisioned by liberals.
Yeah.
It's what they would like to see. So,
or at least non-conservatives.
It may become a movie soon. It's been optioned by some people, and they're developing it. And I've done various other things. I've got a new book called Bleak History, which came out from Simon & Schuster not long ago. A novel, sort of an urban fantasy novel, but I'm always writing novels about things that I'm really skeptical about, and it's about paranormal entities and people with paranormal abilities, and I don't want to say what company. It's being developed as a television series, so we'll see if they go the next step. And actually, I've been so close to having television series about four times, and I get money for them, and I sell them scripts, and then something happens. So I'm hoping that this is the charm, the magic one.
The 12th time's a charm.
Huh?
I said the 12th time's a charm. There's so many. You've already been. Everybody that does this are like, oh, this is it. This is it. This is it. And then, of course, you know, it's not it until there's people sitting in the seats or somebody commercials.
You know, it doesn't really become a reality until, in fact, it's on the screen and people are watching it. And you can even have a pilot shot and in the can, and sometimes they don't even get put on the air.
God, that happens so many times.
I know.
I've even been involved in a couple of LA.
I mean, you know all these stories.
You know, I once knew a pilot that was shot in the can.
You did one?
Yeah, Walter says he knows a pilot that was shot in the can.
The pilot was in the can, and somebody shot him? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Walter is a... have you listened to any of these shows? You know about our friend Walter here?
I don't know.
Walter is former Air Force Office of Special Investigations and FBI.
Oh, okay.
But now he's a screenwriter. Who knew?
Who knew?
And he, when I told him about the subject of today's show, he said, of course I'm going to show up.
All right, fine. Groovy. Groovy, daddy-o.
So we're going to try and talk about, try and call, I guess we're, his name is known as Matthew. Is that his actual name?
Well, that's his first name. We'll see if he wants to give the rest of the stuff. He had to sign NDAs working
right.
for different aerospace companies. So I don't. So he was a little uncertain whether he should give his whole name or not. But we'll see. But you can't get him on at the same time as me? Is that the concept?
I believe we can if we use Walter's cell because the studio phone apparently isn't working. That's one thing about being on this kind of anarchist collective radio station. We can.
About six roaches attacked my beer cap as soon as I set it down.
Wow, we got roaches attacking the food in the studio. You can see what kind of a really cool studio with absolute, you know, absolute credibility.
I've played poker in some really high tone casinos, and there were roaches in the expensive restaurants. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, they're everywhere.
They're probably, you know, in the best studios right now, watching from the rafters and talking over their plans.
Voting on whether they should let pilots and movie scripts go ahead.
It probably ultimately comes down to them. I've often suspected something of the kind. That's who the committee really is. So.
Did you?
The six-legged committee member.
Yeah, members.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that one of the two or three X-Files I saw where they had those giant roach things crawling around, scaring people at the, trying to take over through people at a call center or something. Telemarketing. It was these big roach-like things. Yeah.
That would ex- Yeah, it's somebody's feelings about telemarketing, I think, were emerging in that story.
Well,
somebody
definitely
having to deal with too many telemarketers.
Yeah, if you want to read probably inspiration for many of the X-Files and a lot of the weird stuff you've read in the cyberpunk genre, etc. over the last 20 years, you have to read John's stuff. And I'm sure he'd agree with that. We're going to try and get in touch with Matthew here by calling him on Walter's phone. Walter, do you have his... Here, let's get his number. How do you know this Matthew person, John? I mean, we were messaging back and forth on Facebook, and you said, well, I know a guy that says that these triangles are lighter than aircraft. They were actually really are, and they've been developed quite a few years ago. How do you know Matthew?
Well, he's... I know various people have been in and out of the aerospace industry. In the early days of remote piloted vehicles, I knew a couple of guys who worked in that scene, and this was before where the drone shooting missiles were a commonplace, and it was still a science fiction concept supposedly. But these guys were working on them, and they knew I was interested in them because of my novels, Eclipse, and I wrote about them in those books, where there were like tiny little drones flying around that were being remote controlled somewhere, and they were entering a room and exploding or whatever, and or whopping. And those have become a reality. They have them. They have one that's modeled on a dragonfly now, and it's about the same size. It's not that reliable, but they would get them more reliable. Anyway, so I've been kind of like through research, getting to know people like this. I did some work for the Stanford Futurism Institute and got to know some people there. And I did a little work at MIT. Where you go in and you toss around ideas with people, and with Jack Williamson was there too as part of that. And so I got to know some people there, and also this guy I knew also from, he was at one time a science fiction fan, but he went into aerospace. He's had a very weird history, but he does seem to know his stuff. And so if you can get him, we'll find out how credible he really is. You can grill him.
Okay, I think we do have him. Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Let me set it up so that...
Matthew, you sound like you're talking through a tin can on a string.
Well, basically it is, because we have we have cell phones set up here. The studio line wasn't working, and Walter has donated his... cell phone for right now. It's low tech, but people put up with it because the show is just so majorly awesome. So, John said that you've had a history working with defense contractors. Is this true?
With what again?
With defense contractors.
Oh, yes. a little bit. Working with lighter-than-air and hybrid airships.
Oh, so you've been working directly with the kind of things we're going to talk about tonight.
A little bit, yeah. It's only been through an internship and a little bit of work that I got through the fact that I had been tinkering with the idea of hybrid airships and different ways of using lighter than air that can transition to heavier than aircraft since I was... young, long before the idea or concept was viable, and then when describing this to someone at a conference, they invited someone over who introduced themselves as being somebody who worked with the government on this sort of thing, and I wound up working in a few places like NASA Ames and down at the naval base in San Diego on a few different lighter-than-aircraft, and in the process was exposed to other hybrid airships that I was not working directly on, but they were right there in front of me, and
Now, what do you mean by hybrid?
Hybrid?
Yeah, John.
Is that what you said, hybrid?
Hybrid. They are not entirely intended to be used as lighter than air. They get their lift also from an aerodynamic shape or from wing surfaces that are attached to the airship. There are at least five or six companies that I can think of in Bay Area, California, and Europe that are working on proof of concepts right now. One of them called Hybrid Airships. It has got a 10-meter long test bed that is entirely remote controlled at the moment. That it is intended to fly mostly through a combination of aerodynamics and light and buoyancy through gas bags. So if the thing were left just without any forward motion, the thing would slowly sink to the ground, unable to keep to the air without some sort of forward motion.
Oh, okay. You know, if people are listening, they may not know exactly what we're talking about. We were having problems with the phone, which I apologize to both of our guests for, but that's par for the course at Kill Radio. What brought up the subject originally between John and I is I think I said something about the flying triangles, the Belgian wave of the early 1990s, and how these things had been seen all over the place. And part of my idea was that, well, I mean, I'm not really a UFO believer. I believe something's going on, but I also believe in checking into things to see if they really are actually mysterious enough to warrant being unidentified. And as far as I was concerned with the triangles and boomerangs, that the lighter-than-air explanation at least made sense in part of the cases, but there were some things like sudden changes of movement, acceleration, and things like that that weren't explained, and John said, well, yes, they are, and my friend Matthew knows about this.
The triangle one in specific is one that is still a test bed, has been for a while, but it's one that rather than being like I described before in hybrid, it is a hybrid airship that has a variable geometry, variable buoyancy or density, and vectored thrust, so that the thing is capable of changing its direction of motion pretty accurately. And when it deflates the gas bags on the thing, it's been flying entirely in an aerodynamic mode, is capable of flying really fast. It's one that mostly is still wrapped up under all kinds of classified things, though. I just know about it because I happened to see the airship sitting in a hangar and got to talking with one of the engineers that was working on it.
Was it triangular?
What was that again?
Was it triangular?
Oh, yeah. It was triangular. It had a vector thrust unit at each end. Inflated, it looks kind of like a triangular bagel. Deflated, it looks like a kind of like a stealth bomber or stealth fighter. It's got the aerodynamic surfaces that can be raised or lowered from different points of the triangle. And a cockpit that sat underneath the center section of the thing. I wish I could make more speculation about it because I've only ever seen the model of the thing in flight, and it was impressive, the maneuvering ability that the model had.
So why are you coming on this show to talk about this? So what you're talking about now is not covered by your non-disclosure?
Well, so he's being anonymous, more or less.
Oh, okay, I was saying that the what you're talking about here is not covered by the non-disclosure, and John said, well, he's being anonymous, so it's a little bit different.
More or less. Yeah, it is different.
In this particular case, since I didn't work on the thing and just saw it, it doesn't fall under the non-disclosure agreements. It just falls under, ooh, look at this thing.
It might also not apply. That's true.
It is, I've been told, though, a project that is still considered a classified project. And various people will probably deny it exists, but the fact that when John showed me the pictures of the supposed Belgian UFOs, I was like, that's the freaking airship that I've seen. I was down in the hangar at San Diego, and the model of the head of the thing was being tested at NASA Ames.
And he said that there's a cockpit in the center at the bottom. And I'm looking at the picture of the Belgian UFO, and there is something at the center at the bottom. For what that's worth, it looks like a light at the center of the bottom. It probably would be illuminated. I wonder why they would have run this thing over Belgium. I mean, I think it was some kind of psyops thing, but I don't know.
Well, I think it may have just been an accident of people. The thing could have been ordered over airspace that it wasn't known about, or it could be that this thing could have been the original test bed that was created before the thing became a classified project. Because I know a lot of these things were developed long before the government began to take an interest in them. For instance, I know that back in the 1990s, I tried for a long time to get people at NASA that were friends with my brother and people that I knew that were in the Air Force to look at a proof of concept model that I had made at the time. I got no interest anywhere with anything. And then a few years later, I start noticing that these sorts of concepts are being used in by other companies, particularly dirigible. Began at that point working with vector thrust systems on dirigibles and using composites. Shortly after that, various other companies in Europe began investigating different forms of airship design. That's where the hybrids started to become.
This hybrid airship is more is more maneuverable than a lot of other aircraft might be, though, isn't it? Because of its hybrid nature.
Because of its what nature?
Hybrid nature.
Because it has all these.
It's more
maneuverable than an ordinary lighter than air airship, and more maneuverable than a jet would be. Not faster, but more maneuverable.
Not necessarily than a jet. It depends upon what type of maneuverability you're talking about. It's more maneuverable than a normal airship and more stable because it's got various aerodynamic features and vector thrust systems on it to keep it stable. But it's also capable of doing maneuvers that a jet fighter couldn't do. For instance, in the terms of the ones that are variable density or variable buoyancy, they're capable of reinflating their gas bag, stopping in midair, swiveling around, deflating the gas bags to transition to a heavier-than-air flight mode and speed up to pretty fast speeds for an airship. The ones that don't deflate, just the hybrid airship, by hybrid air, they're talking about speeds of 200 knots without having to deflate anything, just having a ship that, rather than being lighter than air, is neutral buoyancy.
Go ahead. How long have these things been deployed, these hybrid-type craft? And then we'll also get into some of the reported movements and sizes and speeds and stuff.
Any of the big ones? Currently, only Zeppelin has got a large operational airship. The rest of them are smaller proof of concept. Largest one I've seen is about the size, half the size of the Goodyear blimp, and it's the hybrid airship or hybrid air corporation's test bed that they're working out. and, of course, the triangular one down in San Diego. What were we talking about?
why were these things classified?
Some of them were classified?
John was asking why some of them were classified. Well, it sounds like almost all of them are classified.
Because they're capable of, this is just a guess here, based upon what I've seen, that some of these are eventually going to be capable of being built very, very big. Matter of fact, big enough that you could land an airplane on, or, say, launch missiles off of, from a very high altitude.
Save a lot of fuel.
In the mesosphere, where a normal airplane would have a hard time traveling, and use it as a platform to get things into orbit more easily, or in the lower stratosphere as a refueling station for airplanes, or as a long range endurance surveillance platform, so that you could park the thing over an area at an altitude, you know, just around 75,000, 80,000 feet, and be able to see a rather large area of the surface of the Earth beneath it, and yet have very next to no maintenance costs for keeping the thing up there.
Right. There was an article in a magazine called Popular Communications in 2004, which discussed exactly what you're talking about here, about these triangle and boomerang-shaped lighter-than-air ships hovering 65,000 feet or more months at a time. They were constructed with radar-absorbing material. And unless you knew where they were, you wouldn't really know to look for them. And those there were pictures of them, and, you know, that intrigued me at first. And then, of course, we're doing this show with you, telling us your what you've experienced. And I can already hear the UFO people yelling, well, what about the 200-foot-long ones and the football field size ones and all that, and their reported movements. And I don't know if they've ever seen one that's that big going that fast, doing the kind of maneuvers you were talking about. So we may be talking about two different things here. One, the small maneuverable craft, and two, these giant ones that just kind of hover move very slowly like an airship.
If Hybrid Air has actually built their full-size aircraft or full-size airship, it would be 200 to 300 yards long. That's one of the things that's an open question. They have certainly had long enough to have built the thing. Materials technologies are all available now, which weren't available back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when they first began exploring their proof of concept. And that's not even including or counting other companies that may have got into it, like Boeing or Lockheed, who have a little blurb about it on their webpage, but they have nothing specific as far as anything they've been developing. Certainly, it would be quite easy to build an airship that size that was capable of moving at quite a clip.
I got a listener that wrote in with a question. He said, why would you test these things over Belgium, over populated areas, particularly when, if discovered, you could face serious diplomatic incident for breaching their national airspace?
The answer is who knows why, but what is more likely, that it was a large, unusual physical aircraft? I mean, just excluding the possibility that it was just misidentification of, I don't know, atmospheric phenomena or something, but excluding that, what is more likely than that it was a test aircraft of some kind that went someplace it wasn't originally supposed to go, or that was being used to sort of test the reaction of people to a vehicle for psychological purposes? What's more likely, that or a flying saucer from another planet? I mean, we're always going to come back to this Occam's razor comparison, and it's always going to be more likely that there's some kind of oddball screw-up explanation in aerospace than that it came from another solar system.
I agree with you, John, but I would amend it to usually instead of always. I would.
If you want to go back to something even earlier, are you familiar with what the original test bed programs were called for Northrop and for Lockheed for the F-117 and for the B-1 bomber? They were called Tacit Blue and Hav Blue.
Yeah.
And they were developed back in the 70s. And at the same time, there happened to be a project by the Air Force that was, quote, investigating unidentified flying objects. And that project happened to be called Project Blue Book. Turns out that Project Blue Book was just out documenting who had seen Hav Blue and Tacit Blue. The triangular UFO is probably another instance of a government project of some sort or pre-government project that happened to have, in this case, it probably could have been easy to have been blown off course if it was an early testbed project that didn't yet have the full dynamic rules that the later models would have.
Well, I would think Hav Blue and Tacit Blue.
It could have simply been a test that went wrong. They could have lost control of their, navigation or something. That's always going to be more likely than the fantastic explanation. But go on, Greg. I'm sorry.
Or somebody in the government agreed to it. No matter what the consequences.
They had their own oddball reasons too. You know, I think it was as far back as the 1940s. There were CIA memos. There was a CIA memo. Was it in the 1940s or the early 50s? It's been reproduced in a lot of places, this memo about this whole UFO business could be used in psychological operations, quote unquote.
Yes,
and,
well,
you know,
of course.
What did they mean by that? And what? How did they actually deploy that? And that's an issue that I think that, didn't you write a book about wasn't it you wrote a book about how a lot of UFO events were created for just a kind of a smoke screen or something by the government?
I described
cover something else up.
I described an incident, well, a series of incidents, a situation that went on for a few years where someone who was a UFO researcher was encouraged to spread crazy stories basically to cover up some national security concerns about development.
Right.
Of...
I've always thought that what was it, the supposed MJ-12 document was fabricated by that person or those people.
Yeah, well, I would think so too, and so did the original person that discovered them now thinks that, Bill Moore. But anyway... Matthew's still with us, and he's been trying to say something.
The deliberate use of misinformation, like you're talking about, it could have been, if you want to bring out another hypothetical version or explanation for why the triangular UFO was seen, it could have been intentionally displayed in order to get people saying it's a UFO rather than a real project. I mean, I don't know how many military operations I've seen where they fly all over the sky throwing flares out in order to get people to look at that side of the sky rather than looking what's going on the other side of the sky where something really interesting might be happening. It could be a case.
Oh, yeah, the Russians did something like that. Didn't the Russians do something like that specifically? Where they were staging something in order for us to not notice that they were doing some kind of missile testing?
Well, what they did... Go ahead, Matthew. Sorry.
What was that again?
John says, didn't the Russians do something like that where they were staging a distraction so that we wouldn't notice the missile testing they were doing? I did.
They were creating a fog of UFO reports or something so that people would discount missile tests?
Even we do that.
Sounds just as vague as some UFO reports, but okay.
So... you know, the Russians are not taking anything out of any new playbook in that regard.
Right. They did. What happened, and I described in my book, was that in the 1950s they were testing missile telemetry in southern Russia near the Asian subcontinent, the CIA had stations there, and they were listening to the telemetry, and the telemetry was deliberately screwed up. So they would think, so the CIA would think that they weren't getting anywhere, and they were their missile tests weren't going very well.
Yeah.
My friend Walter here was actually involved for many years in using the UFO subject in counterintelligence. Oh, weren't you?
No. That's a bit of an exaggeration.
Okay.
Many years. What you're talking about there is just a well-known tactic, perception management, and it's very effective. And
perception management?
Yeah, I happen to like it.
I love that phrase. Perception management. I love that.
Something that every time I see in a newspaper or television story about, you know, lights over Phoenix or you know, dancing lights in New Mexico, it always strikes me as that sort of thing. Perception management. That you know, what is it exactly that they're trying to keep us from seeing by diverting our attention with the dancing flares and.
Yeah,
I've got a friend who Ted Oliphant, who did a lot of research about the so-called cattle mutilations. He was obsessed with that because when he was a police officer in Alabama, he kept getting reports of them, and lights would come down people's field, and they'd find these mutilated cattle, and so he started like setting up little you know, surveillance posts and watching these areas with different people, and they finally saw a unmarked helicopter that was like lifting off from one of these things, and they followed it and in a car, and it was going, you know, it was difficult because it was like it was able to go straight and they had to turn and everything, but they were able to keep it in sight, and it went to a military base. And they filmed it and going in the base, and then they called the base the next day and tried to say, well, why was this landing in this guy's field, and why, you know, he came back to your base, and they said, no, well, we have no helicopters, no such thing, you know, but we saw it. I'm a police officer, and you know, so I mean, it. He says that the information that he got ultimately was that it had to do with biological warfare. Testing, they would like spray an area with some kind of germ, and the germ was not going to really kill things particularly. It was just testing your ability to put out a germ, and the ability to disseminate a germ, and the ability of a germ to jump from into animals, and it was related to some other germ they were thinking of using. And then they had, in order to kind of confirm things, they had to do it out in a you know, like out in the field, rather than at some remote base where they just have a bunch of animals or something. They did that too, but they wanted to, and so then they would, for some reason, they had to come down and take physical samples from these animals in order, and it was supposedly related to this obscure military biological worker program, and everything else around it was sort of smoke that they themselves have promoted, like they made up some of their own UFO stories in order to cover it up, because it was a very embarrassing program, and people, you know, American farmers were losing animals, and
well, John,
I don't know, I have no proof any of this is that, you know, that is the explanation for cattle mutilation, but it seems more plausible than some of the others I've heard.
Well, John, you haven't read anything that I've written over the last few years, because basically I've said the same thing you just said.
Oh.
And some of it came from Ted. Some of it came from people, especially in New Mexico, that have gone deeper into the subject and checked out where these things were coming from, what was happening, what was being, you know, what was going on with the cattle. Like, some of them had been marked with an invisible paint, which I don't think aliens would be using invisible paint. there's still some very strange aspects of the phenomenon, but they're dwarfed by the mundane aspects, mundane to be sure, but also rather frightening in the implications about biological warfare, about possibly engineered viruses getting out into the animal population and spreading to the wild animal population, etc. But that's a subject for another show because we still have Matthew here.
Thank you.
Yeah, and John, you know what? We can have you, and I would love to have you back in a couple weeks and have our long-awaited second debate. We had one a few years ago, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I just found it, actually. I found the recording, so I could put that up right against the new one. Matthew, do you know of any other aerial platforms that might have caused these strange sightings besides the ones you were working on?
Not anything I can talk about. there are a few hypotheticals that I had heard pitched around when I was working. Most of them involve stealth concepts and replacements for the SR-71 and things like that. And most of the time, I spent just worried about, you know, getting the vector thrust system I was working on to work. Yeah. And being excited that, look, all these ideas that I had when I was a kid actually are working.
Matthew, have you ever come across anything referred to as frictionless hydraulics?
Frictionless hydraulics?
Yeah.
Not off the top of my head, no.
Well, what is that, Walter?
That's something I learned from my father before he died. He was in the Air Force in the late 50s, and I've talked about him here on the show before. And he worked in the early days of Mercury, the space program, and such. And he had told me quite an amazing story about a platform. He referred to them as the Flying Squares. He saw them demonstrated while assigned to George Air Base out here in the Mojave Desert, and he told me quite an interesting story about these things, and that they were a technology. This was in 1957 he saw them, and they worked with, the best way to describe them would be anti-gravity platforms. He said they were very large, and they could shoot up into, high up into the stratosphere, atmosphere, whatever, and they would carry cargo and personnel up to craft that were high orbital or very high altitude craft up there that were ours. And he told an interesting tale about who had developed these for the Air Force, and they had originally tested them in Kansas. And like I said, he saw them demonstrated, but they used a principle called frictionless hydraulics. And quite an interesting story, but it kind of matches the description of like what you saw, you know, the high altitude platforms that could be used for, so it makes you wonder how long these things have been around and how much of the UFO mystery they explain.
I know with things like the Man High Project, that they did a lot of research with high altitude balloon platforms, and a great deal of that is still classified. I'm not sure I would put too much stock in the concept of frictionless hydraulics as an anti-gravity device. I even among some of the other material that I know about, haven't seen anything that comes near to being able to defy gravity, and at least in the way you're talking about. I've seen some things that show an ability to get single stage to orbit craft into an operational state of some sort. Various types of hybrid engines and propulsion devices that use plasma or different types of magneto-hydrodynamic drives that ionize the air in front of the vehicle, and then use a super ejecting magnets along the length of the craft to repel it. But that pretty much like the scramjet that NASA is using, as far as I know about, is still in early trials.
Yeah, they just, I think NASA Ames just flew one over the Pacific last year for the first time. Oh, no, it was a, It was a ramjet. Well, I don't know. Maybe it was a hybrid of a ramjet, scramjet.
The scramjet, the X-53, I believe, is what just flew. It did something like a Mach 6 to 9 flight for 5 minutes. Which was a real feat as far as aerodynamics of that sort. But just as a guess, I would guess that technology is probably a little further along in military application than it is in civilian.
Yeah, well, we've discussed that on the show a lot, too, and I'm sure John knows about this, that a lot of the things that we talk about and we see on the news and all this, especially having to do with the military and military hardware, is somewhere between 10 and 20 years ahead of where the public affairs office tells us it is.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that just the airships that I've worked on, that, you know, most of them were seen as proof of concept or test bed or work in progress. But many of them had the appearance to me, at least from what I was working on, of things that had parts that seemed to come prefabbed, and all we would be doing was working on mounting it on a new platform. And
sorry, that happens a couple times a show.
Many of others that we're working on this is, you know, why are we working with prefab parts that supposedly are sort of, you know, prototype? Now, why are we getting a system that seems to have come off of something else?
Yeah, well, it sounds like a compartmentalized thing where everybody works on the part that they're familiar with. Although it seems like you've seen things all the way to the end of, as you said, proof of concept.
Let me see if I can find it here for a second. I had a couple of documents that I had pulled up specifically for this. Hybrid air.
That Naval Weapons Center has also been involved with testing a very small, for many years now, since the 80s, I think, very small, what are they called, lifting platforms with a ducted fan inside them that have cameras and things on them they can send into battlefields, etc.
Yeah, that little things that are basically about 8 inches in diameter, about a foot long, that are capable of being deployed in a cloud. That's basic UAV technology, and I know using one of the airships is another type of UAV technology that it is the one down in San Diego that is fairly large for a UAV, that deploys at a high altitude and carries with it small satellite drones that it can then drop off to, you know, explore the area around it and then fly back to it. You can park the thing way up in the upper atmosphere and bring it down to a lower the atmosphere when you need to deploy the different drones for specific applications, the satellite drones that drop off of it.
Did you find your document yet?
No, I can't remember if I have it on my iPad, my desktop, or my laptop at this moment, and I'm trying to get the whole network.
I know John's still on the line because I can see his name on my cell phone. I didn't mean for you to shut up, John. If you have stuff that you want to ask or say, please go right ahead.
No, I'm hoping that Walter will reveal some secrets from his past.
You have to go to the Radio Mysterioso site and listen to some of the old shows. He reveals he's revealed some of them. Walter's just said you might not want to hear any of them.
Pretty much the extent of what I've, you know, done with these things is, you know, what I've told you, and I was just trying to look up one of the things that Hybrid Air had done that and get a description of their craft.
All you have to do really is for most people listening is go online. There are things you can't believe that they have up online publicly that are available for you to look at right now if you know what the search terms are.
Oh, yeah. the bigger hybrid airships from Hybrid Air. It's called the Walrus. If you go and do a YouTube search of just P-791 Hybrid Airship Project, it'll give you a picture of one of these gigantic airships. And it's still just a proof of concept.
Was that the one they were testing in Palmdale? It basically looks like a big blimp with looks like maybe four fans underneath it.
Yes. In
giant pods or something. Yeah, I posted that one up on the UFO Mystic site a couple of years ago when that story first came out, or somebody, the company that was testing it, I don't know if it was Boeing or Lockheed or one of the larger contractors had brought that out in broad daylight and tested it and it put a video up of it.
Well, Lockheed Skunk Works is who's helping develop the technology and put the thing together. But it was originally a concept by the Hybrid Air,
You know, one reason I was thinking of that you might get a really strange manifestation of a experimental aircraft, and for example, maybe the one over Belgium, might be because suppose that you have a company that's developing it and trying to raise, you know, additional funds, trying to get, you know, maybe it's essentially in kind of showing off. Look what we can do, and then we can put this thing out there. We can get all these observations of it, and then we can make it disappear, essentially. You know, and it's almost as if they're showing off a stealth capability. We can show it, and then we can take it away. I mean, it could be that, you know, in order to impress, someone somewhere. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you're saying, and it does make sense in light of the fact that these things were seen and were seen publicly and continue to be seen.
For instance, the P-791, long before it was built, the hybrid air vehicles had been testing their prototype, which was 60 feet long down in... down in San Diego, and before that, in the UK, near Bedfordshire. Air Force Base, someplace near there. Hybrid Air Vehicles was doing their original proof of concept with this thing, and, it was a fairly big vehicle itself, and the P-791 is gigantic compared to it. These things are all over the place. You've got all kinds of small companies that are popping up with, technologies that were not available to your everyday person or everyday small company, 10 years ago. But now they can get carbon fiber, they can get various composites used in a thing, and different chemical systems that are used for generating the gas so that they will have a large supply of it on board to be able to inflate and deflate their airship to transition between either a neutral buoyancy or lighter than air into heavier than aircraft. And there's no telling who is seeing these small companies, just their projects, and then along comes government and says, we want to develop this for a project, and suddenly the thing becomes black, and all evidence disappears after that.
Yeah, there's
people wondering, what was it I saw?
Yeah. I got a triangulation for you, at least another data point. Where did you get that information about the testing over England?
The testing over England? Oh, that I just knew about.
Oh, okay, because there's a... March 30th, 1993, multiple witnesses across southwest and west England saw a large black triangle moving at low speed. It appeared over a northeasterly course from Cornwall to Shropshire over a period of approximately 6 hours. Clearly report visible objects over densely populated areas and highways. That's another thing, is that and John did bring this up, a lot of these things are flying basically where lots of people can see them.
Well, it's, as I said, if hybrid air vehicles, I know that the large hybrid airship that they've got, which is just, it is a lighter than air craft that just happens to use aerodynamics along with lighter than air, or it's actually got controlled buoyancy. It's what they call, meaning that they can control from neutral to lighter than air rather than going below neutral buoyancy. But they had pursuits other projects in the works before they got picked up by the military.
Yeah, well, these projects, they're, I guess there's all kinds of secondary technologies that can be used out of these projects.
Of course, before they get picked up by the military, they're just going to be testing anywhere they can, near private airfields where they can set up their airship, inflate it, fly it around, bring it back, pack it back into a crate, and drive off.
You know what would be interesting, and I don't know if this could ever happen, but it would be really, really interesting to get a nighttime video of one of these craft you're talking about doing what it says you say that they can do, which sounds perfectly reasonable to me. I mean, it sounds like it obeys the laws of physics as we know them, etc. And video that and show it to a group of UFO people and a group of military people or people that are into it, pilots, something like that, or and to a group of completely neutral people and see what they say it is.
Yeah, I agree that you would see a lot of people that would say, you know, oh, that's a UFO of some sort. UFO meaning an extraterrestrial craft, because a bird is a UFO if you don't know really what it is. It just right. flew by, and you knew something flew by, but it's unidentified. But in this case, yeah, UFO meaning an extraterrestrial, many people would probably mistakenly think it was some sort of craft of extraterrestrial origin.
Well, there is a perception management thing that we've talked about that on the show. Obviously, you don't know about it, but we've talked about we're talking about unidentified. But when you say UFO, people automatically, 100% of the time, almost assume aliens from other planets flying here in structured craft. But no, all it means is unidentified.
Or the military reverse engineering some aircraft from extraterrestrial technology.
Right.
That's the one that I get so tired of hearing.
It's just like, it's as if all these things invented by all these great human inventors, though they couldn't have done that, you know. It's really dissing all these great human scientists and inventors to say it had to be retro-engineered from some crash UFO.
It is insulting the engineers and scientists who came up with the original concepts, and if you really want to get down to it, any sort of extraterrestrial agency that would be capable of making it interstellar distances is surviving the vacuum of space, as it were, and the radiation that there is there, would be to a technological state that we would have no means of detecting them. I mean, we already ourselves are almost to the point of being able to build stealth devices that will completely cloak the visible light from an object. So that sort of metamaterial is something that would also be useful in space for controlling the radiation inside of a life support environment. So any sort of extraterrestrial would likely have that same sort of technology where we would have no way of seeing them. Or going towards nanotech, if they had robust nanotechnology, they could deploy just smart dust into the atmosphere and wouldn't need to send a vehicle down in.
Yeah, well, we've also talked about that on the show as well, about the weirdness of a lot of the UFO stuff and the nonsensicalness, and it doesn't really make sense that anything would be coming from that far away just to fuck with us. You know what I mean? And if they didn't want to be seen, they wouldn't be.
I can understand. I mean, there is some merit to Douglas Adams. I can't remember what he called them, but the aliens, basically teenage aliens who come down on Earth just to show themselves to some yahoo out in the middle of nowhere that no one's going to
teenagers, that they stole their mom's car. You know? They stole their mom's extraterrestrial vehicle.
You're both talking over each other.
I don't see any sense behind most of the accounts of extraterrestrial UFOs.
Okay, for the past 10 seconds or 20 seconds, we couldn't hear anything either of you were saying because you didn't realize you were both talking at the same time. Sorry.
Okay.
So, what did you say, John? Did you say about, something about teenage kids?
I just like the idea that, if alien craft were here, their ridiculous behavior might be explained by the fact that they're essentially alien adolescents, and they've stolen their parents' extraterrestrial craft, and they come here, and it's just like a kick. They come to Earth to screw with us, the same way that teenagers will go in their parents' car out to the country, and they'll do cow tipping.
Yes.
They'll tip over some cows or something, you know. They'll throw eggs at a farmer and then drive off, you know.
Yeah, well, John, that would explain
some stuff.
You did write that great piece for the magazine once about sort of that same thing, but it had to do with cattle mutilation.
I don't remember which piece.
You wrote a piece for me for Excluded Middle about a guy going out and kidnapping aliens who were kidnapping cattle and shoving things up.
Oh, yeah, that was fiction. Yeah, he was going out and he was setting up a blind where he was hoping to catch one, and then he did catch them, and he inserted things up their alien butts and stuff. Yeah, and he probed the aliens in the story. Yeah,
I got more comments about that story. More. That was one of the best stories in the magazine. So thank you again, 10 years later, for writing that.
By the way, an interesting website to keep an eye on. And it's like just the froth at the top of what's going on at this company. It's kind of like maybe Walter knows, it's Sandia National Laboratories, sandia.gov, S-A-N-D-I-A, .gov. And they, you know, they seem to like they are overlap between being private and being government, and it's hard to tell, really, but... I think they're mostly private, but they're just constantly working for the government. And they have some of the strangest, most they're like a group of mad scientists. They're in California here somewhere, and every so if you look at their website, they have some wild stuff that, and then this is just the stuff they're allowed to talk about. And when I was at the Stanford Research Institute consulting, I talked to some people who had talked to some other people at Sandia, and they were working on very strange directed energy weapons and all kinds of science fictional projects, or things that would be science fiction, except in this place they're real. They do a lot of defense work, and I'm just clicking on their thing at random. The links to radar synthetic, here it is. The strategically hardened defeat program. They have a lot of really complex UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. They're developing new anti-missile programs that are basically directed energy devices for shooting down missiles, and there's somebody to keep an eye on. They might have caused some UFO reports at some point. Sandia Labs.
Go ahead, Matthew. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say Sandia is a privately owned lab that is basically a DARPA contractor. And responsible for some awesome technology. Not only what John has talked about, but some of the projects involving high-altitude surveillance that there might be some crossover with the airships with. I'm familiar with that, you know, they had a guy down at NASA Ames and San Diego Naval Station that was supposedly a liaison, but I never found out what he did other than that he was there paying attention to our project.
Go ahead.
But the other thing I was going to say is I agree with John about the extraterrestrial teenager. That's my theory as well, is that if any ET stories involving the probing or whatever is going on, it's a bunch of alien teenagers who have stolen their parents' car.
You mentioned Sandia, John. Actually, that was in the Project Beta as well, the book I wrote about the guy that was fooled by the Air Force. Actually, he kind of fooled himself, and the Air Force helped him. But Sandia has been involved in numerous defense projects for probably since, maybe Matthew can correct me, since probably the 1970s, maybe earlier.
Oh, yes, at least. They've been involved with DARPA since they were founded. And I'm pretty sure they were founded with the intention of working with DARPA. And I would...
Yeah, DARPA was the Fifth Advanced Research Project something.
Or looking to San Diego National Laboratories for a propulsion system for a single-stage-to-orbit aircraft sometime in the next few years.
Yeah, Sandia has been, John's right, if you go to their site, once again, the stuff that's available publicly is sometimes frightening.
Yeah, that's just the froth at the top. That's the stuff they're allowed to talk about.
They've been working on aerial lasers that are powerful enough to cut through airplanes and stuff since the 1970s, and apparently they just now, this year, released a film of a nighttime test of a laser shooting a missile down from an airplane.
Yeah, they've been, the 747 with the laser on it has been basically doing that for the last few years, and they've just come out with videos to show, look, we can actually do this. There is reason to continue putting money into it.
The problem, I think, for the longest time, and this was actually, I talked to a Sandia, a scientist at work for Sandia, when I was working on the book, and it had nothing to do with what I was describing in the book, but he told me that the problem they had for the longest time was being able to produce enough power to get that laser powered up to the point where it could do that kind of damage, because they couldn't lift the power apparatus into the air.
Right.
But they got to the point where they could actually carry the weight and the weight, and they miniaturized it enough so that they could actually get the power requirements for running that laser that would do those kind of things.
It's a chemical battery pack now, rather than being something like a battery or capacitor. They have two, sometimes three different chemicals, depending upon what type of chemical laser it is, that are mixed together, and the chemicals cause the actual lasing of the light, and very high powerful. Problem with that is that it's only usable a few times before you have to land and unload tons of chemicals from the thing. I believe in the airborne laser, the idea is to have a pack that you can just pull out as a unit and put in as a unit.
Oh, I see, yeah. What'd you say, Walter?
Would not a pulse weapon be easier than the laser?
Pulse weapons are hard to aim, and you have to have the pulses landing in pretty much the same place, or you're burning off a lot of extras material. Beam weapon tends to be better in that it's capable of heating a localized area at a consistent rate, whereas a pulse laser, between each pulse, you have a plasma cloud that's generated that refracts the next incoming pulse, and you have dissipation of heat from the structure itself that's being targeted.
Well, I was thinking in terms of if
you could find enough power pulse laser that pulsed fast enough, yes, pulse laser would be incredibly damaging. But again, it's just a matter of we don't have the materials technology for it yet.
As far as you know.
That we know of. Who knows what's being tested?
I couldn't hear that.
Go ahead, Walter.
No, I'm saying in what you've seen, and it sounds like you've seen some really cool stuff and worked with some really cool stuff. To the extent of your knowledge, you can say that they don't have this stuff then.
They don't have the...
Like what we were just talking about, the pulse technology kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, the pulse technology is too immature at this point.
Oh. Which technology is this? I couldn't hear.
The pulse.
Coal?
No, pulsed pulsed energy weapon.
Right.
A pulsed laser is currently too immature a technology to be useful for shooting down missiles, strategically at least. It might be useful in a tactical environment, but not for the strategic missile that their missile defense system that they're talking about using with the 747.
Oh, I see. Oh, pulse.
Yes, pulse. P-U-L-S-E.
Oh, pulse. Oh, okay.
Yes. The other thing is Sandia also was, well, maybe they weren't. There's an optical place called the Starfire Optical Range, which is at Kirtland Air Force Base, where Sandia has a large presence. And also with the, this is one of the things that the... they were covering up when this guy was seeing UFOs supposedly over the military base, was a they were testing a, what's it called? Now I can't even remember, and I wrote about it. Atmospheric, it's a system that gets rid of atmospheric disturbances so that when a laser is going through the atmosphere, it doesn't get... diffused by the different air densities, and it was they use this in astronomy now, but it was originally developed to keep to look into space so they could see satellites coming over, and two to micromanage the where the lasers were being put, these laser weapons were being pointed, so that the atmosphere didn't dissipate them by the time they got to their target.
Yeah, they ionized the atmosphere with a different beam first to. The laser that's the weapon system, and it consequently is useful for adaptive optics.
Adaptive optics.
Astronomy.
Thank you.
Yeah, it,
they send a different beam first to sort of burn a hole through the air or make a path.
Yes, that's basically the idea, John.
The atmosphere gives you a correction that you can use to adapt the optics of a telescope to match the different densities of the atmosphere that you're going through. The same system is used on the airborne laser, that it has a primary beam that ionizes the atmosphere to create a fresh channel for the target beam to go through so that you don't have to deal with the adaptive optics problem.
Oh, okay. Matthew, I've got a picture which I didn't get in the book, but it's a very strange picture of a beam of some sort in broad daylight being shot straight up from this optics lab, and it stops in midair. It just stops, like halfway up through the atmosphere. So it appears to be doing.
I'd have to see the thing. Is it green just by any...
it might be. I think it's kind of a very, very light green. I think it's more actually sort of yellowish, at least in this picture. It was taken at about with a shutter speed of a thousandth of a second in the middle of the day in New Mexico, pointed at that lab in 1979 or so, 1980.
That would be something that might have to do with a solar observatory that's out there that... Again, I'd have to see it in no location to know for sure.
All right. Do you know anybody else? I know you work in on a lot of these classified projects is, have you met other people that are interested in the, you know, any possible reality, so-called, to the unidentified flying objects? Because I've met a lot of scientists who are truly interested in it, but they don't want to talk about it to anybody. They don't necessarily believe there's aliens coming here, but they'd like to find out what the hell's going on with a lot of things that remain unexplained.
Most of the people I know are incredibly skeptical about any sort of extraterrestrial visitors to the Earth. It's a surefire way to get you really marginalized,
right,
to come out and say, oh, I think that there are extraterrestrials watching us or something like that. That would be a really good way to slow down your career.
Of course it is, and it probably should be. But the thing is that there are other explanations, maybe not explanations, but things that people can be looking at that may not necessarily be extraterrestrial, but are possibly unexplored or amazing to our point of view right now. And the fact that there's a lot of crazies, wackos, and dipshits around the subject keeps serious people from being interested in pursuing any aspect of the phenomenon that might be serious or indeed researchable.
Well, I know that if I had a regular job to worry about and the work that I've done, and I'm back in school studying for another degree at this point, actually, and deals with neuroscience, but I know that if I were to stay in that industry, I would not be talking about this right now.
Yeah, but you can, because we're just using your first name.
Yes, I understand that. And I would probably be more careful about it than I am now. It's one of those things that, like I said, it can put a real dent in your career opportunities to have anybody find out that you've been talking to people about UFOs.
Right.
Even if it's just to debunk stuff.
So, Warren, especially don't talk to Greg Bishop.
Yeah, you have to.
What was that?
But John said, especially don't talk to Greg.
You're talking to Greg here, so.
Yeah. Well, you've already done it. So too bad. I've lured you into my trap, and your life is ruined.
Yes. Yes. Oh no.
You don't even really think about the subject. It's just kind of something that's, to your mind, is just all unidentified things or things that just haven't been explained yet. Is that how you'd characterize your opinion of the subject?
Things that people have either misunderstood what they've seen, or things that eventually would have an explanation that would be perfectly sensible. Sort of like, as I explained, the Project Blue Book was just a case of tracking actual sightings of HABBLU and TACIBLU. Eventually, there will probably be a similar project of, you know, the Air Force and Navy going around talking to people, tracking actual sightings of their different airships or their different test aircraft.
I think they probably still do that. When were HABBLU and TACIBLU in operation? Weren't those in the 70s?
TACIBLU and HABBLU, yeah, 70s. They started, I believe, in 1974 was when the first one actually flew, and it was the same year that they began talking about putting together a project to investigate UFOs that got named Project Blue Book eventually. And then I don't know if you remember the TV series about it. It was just laughable.
Project Blue Book ran from 1950, the early 50s to 1969.
Project Blue Book?
Yes. It was disbanded in 1969 because they just didn't want to deal with the problem of keeping it going. That's not to say that they haven't used something after that to gather information on what people thought was going through the skies. I'm sure very interested in, the Air Force and military contractors are very interested in what people think they're seeing.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which is why the counterintelligence is very interested in people that hang around UFO groups, especially if they're not U.S. citizens.
Yeah.
Who's done that kind of thing?
Have you, Walter?
Who would ever do that kind of thing?
When I first met Walter, I talked to him, and I realized that he had attended a UFO conference in San Diego at some point that I was at, and there were Russian people there selling UFO material and just saying, oh, hello, we are from Russia, and we want to talk to you about UFOs. And he was there to find out what the hell they were doing there and if it had any implications to for national security. Because this was in 19...
Mid-90s,
yeah. Way in the mid-90s after supposedly the quote-unquote fall of the Soviet Union.
Well, I understand that the Russians kind of have this love affair with strange things like psychics and extraterrestrials and things like that. I've never really met any personally, but I read about it an awful lot.
The concern that we had that I was working was any Russian intelligence officers who would have been using this interest in weird things as a means to collect on our Air Force technology at our installations, which was a very real concern. That was our extent of interest in that. Because you're right, yeah. There's people all over the world that are interested in the, you know, these weird things, but in that particular instance, that was the issue I was working, looking for actual intelligence collections.
There was
collecting, and how exactly?
Well, one way you could do it is ingratiate yourself in UFO groups and, you know, be part of organized events where you go out, say, and you're aiming your cameras and your binoculars into a place called Area 51 or a base called Wright Pat or any of the desert locations. I worked one issue, which I will not go into detail, about an individual that was doing just that, a foreign national. And
I was just thinking that actually if I was the KGB, it never occurred to me before that it would be really smart to infiltrate some groups that watch, you know, for UFOs, because they might find out about
our technology,
secret programs.
Absolutely, and that's what I was working in the mid '90s, that specific issue, as an OSI agent. And
your really high tech classified stuff has moved from the Groom Lake area or Area 51 to was it Edwards out in the middle of the desert in California.
Well, I just used Area 51 as an example. The specific areas I was working the issue on were here in California, and that's what I can't go into detail on. But absolutely. And it would be the GRU specifically, just to name one group, the agency that would do it. It was a very valid concern. Otherwise, wouldn't have been doing it.
So I've heard that project, you know, that some of the supposed, the first prototypical program to make, to use UFOs as a cover for military activity was basically Roswell. And that they didn't want people to know about Mogul, and that Kenneth Arnold provided them with a sort of a cover story or something.
I personally don't believe the Mogul story, and I am was when I was on active duty acquainted with the guy who wrote that official book, Colonel Weaver, and I don't even personally buy the Mogul story. I think that's a cover thing. I do believe that the ET legend that has grown up around Roswell has been pretty much an easy cover that was given to definitely cover very earthbound technology. I think that's what was going on at Roswell.
There was another story that it was testing that had to do with human bodies that were burned in aircraft or something, and they would take these corpses and put them in aircraft, and it was like kind of an embarrassing project. So they were like covering up what it was. Is you know what I'm talking about? I vaguely remember this.
I
had to do with burn like victims in aircraft, and that created the impression even of some sightings of ET corpses because the bodies were shriveled up from being burned.
Hmm, it's a possibility.
I forget where I heard that. Maybe it was. I forgot where I heard that, but that was one theory. I think it was Kevin Randall told me about that.
It's a possibility, you know, among many. I've written about one possibility that I got from a source that I didn't personally witness. Joseph Farrell, I think, has done some of the best research and has a book out there now, Roswell and the Reich, that just cannot be ignored if you're interested in Roswell. It can't be ignored. And I don't believe it can be easily dismissed either, although many people try. I definitely believe that it was something much more earthbound going on than extraterrestrial where Roswell was concerned.
What's your opinion about?
Roswell and the Reich. It's a fairly recent release by Joseph P. Farrell.
What's the premise?
That it was Nazi technology of the era that was actually being tested and that is what crashed.
Nazi technology.
Pardon?
Nazi technology?
Yes.
Did you say Nazi?
Yes, he did. What was that? Yes, he did. What was that, Matthew?
What was that again? Hello?
Oh, there's a... we were talking about a book that looks at Roswell as the possible explanation for the Roswell incident, so-called, as a cover-up of captured or tested Nazi technology, which is why the... why the secrecy and the embarrassment factor was in place there, and why it's still a secret, because there might have been some and still be a political reason for covering that up, so specifically having Nazis over here working on stuff.
Yeah,
because they did bring Nazi technicians. Of course, Wernher von Braun was the best-known one, but they did bring up other Nazi technicians. Germany after World War II to do work on secret American projects.
Right, that was Operation Paperclip, but specifically the idea is that the Roswell incident involved some advanced, originally Nazi-developed technology that, for a variety of reasons, they would want to keep that secret. And I think that's a much more reasonable explanation. I'm not saying I'm sure it is. I'm saying it's a much more reasonable explanation than the E.T. religion. Oh, excuse me. I meant to say E.T. hypothesis.
All right. Well, that's interesting. I'll have to look at this book.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with that. I can't see anything having to do with 1947? Did that happen?
Yeah, 1947.
Yeah, I certainly can't see any of our technology in 1947 being capable of shooting down a UFO. And the fact that we did, at that time, have a lot of Nazi scientists that we were working with on all kinds of programs, it wouldn't surprise me if it turned out to be a covering of an embarrassing project that we were working on.
Yeah, that sort of thing still happens today. Is he saying he met a Nazi scientist? I couldn't quite make all of that out. But
Matthew, John said he couldn't quite make all of it out. What did you say? Just say now in a nutshell.
Saying that you met a Nazi scientist?
Immediately after World War II, we had a lot of Nazi scientists working for us.
Yes, that's true.
It would not surprise me if Roswell turned out to be an incident of one of these scientists doing something embarrassing that we needed to cover up.
Well, that's apparently the subject of this book, Roswell and the Reich.
Well, the subject of it is not only that, but a technology that was advanced enough that in aerodynamics or something even beyond that, that's yeah, no, more national security concern than a political or embarrassing, you know, a source of embarrassment. At least that's Joseph's idea in the book. I haven't read the whole book, but at the beginning, whatever you think of the book, I like, and John would like this too. He said, well, if we look at all the evidence for Roswell and what I've brought up, we have to decide if the evidence I bring up is more plausible merely, you know, for the plain fact that it's more plausible because we know about it. We know about this technology now. We know about the politics of the time. And we know about, you know, the people that came over and started our jump-started our aerospace program. So, you know, when he starts out with that premise, it makes me want to read a little, read to the end of the book. And I'm about, I don't know, 30 pages into it right now. It's Adventures Unlimited, so they just, since they're one of my publishers, they sent me a copy. Roswell and the Reich.
He claims that it was piloted by children.
I don't know what he claims. Why did you say that?
I'm reading about it online. It says, a product of Nazi technology and piloted by children.
Well, Walter's read the whole book, and he said, well, he never says any such thing in the book.
I'm not reading somebody's summary of it. Afflicted by premature aging or something.
No, that's that's Nick's book.
No, that's not Joseph Farrell at all. That's Greg says that's Nick Redfern's book.
That's Body Snatchers in the Desert.
That's Body Snatchers in the Desert. We're talking about Roswell and the Reich by Joseph P. Farrell.
Well, somebody's got it described wrongly here. Okay.
Well, yeah. Well, somebody on the net.
Yeah, well, everything's correct if it's on the net, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when you really...
it must be true.
I think when you really get into studying, not just Joseph, there's other sources of, you know, what the Germans were actually, the scientists were actually getting into as early as the 30s and even the 1920s, that it's not unreasonable when you get into Joseph's book that... you know, Roswell, the Roswell incident as we know it, the legend, is a bit of an exaggeration of something that might have been, you know, being engineered back then. And it's when you're familiar with what they were doing all through the pre-war and the war era, you know, then you get to this incident that happens just 2 years after the war ends. It, you know, it's a lot more reasonable than it may seem to, you know, a lot of folks, but... you know, I have found, at least in my experience in the world of secrets and classified, is there's a lot of compartmentalization, and nobody works in everything. And you know, I like to think that that, you know, all I know is what I experienced and what I was read in on and what I saw, but I can't speak to everything that's out there. So I kind of tend to keep an open mind on what could be. Within, you know, I try to do it within reason, of course, but.
What were you going to say, Matthew? It sounded like he was about to speak.
Oh, I said, that, yes, I agree with there's a lot of compartmentalization in the intelligence community and any sort of project that is deemed secret of any sort, that, you know, you're never given the whole story about what's going on. You know, and I felt that same way working on the airship materials. You know, we were only giving pieces of it, and most of the time we figured out what the hell it was we were doing, which helped us to finish the project. But just an incredible amount of deconstructing things to the point where you sometimes have no clue as to what the hell you're doing.
Yeah, there's a reason that when people come and start talking about what they were working on, it's just they have to guess about a lot of it, and it ends up sounding insane because they had to guess. I talked to a guy who worked for the DOD for quite a while. When I was speaking at a conference, he just came up to me and started talking to me. He said he designed a basically a safe house for reading documents. A document would be left inside, and a guy would walk in and read them, and then somebody would come out before, you know, come in and get the document before the guy left. It was specifically designed architecturally so that, it was impossible to, you know, pass a document or take pictures or whatever. But the thing was that he got the contract, and they said, well, you have to, you know, you've got 6 months to design this. So a guy came and interviewed him to get his clearance, his security clearance, and he finished the project and turned it in. And they had a guy come and get the project, the plans from him, and he said, why? They're my plans. I'm still working on them. And, you know, we might need to change them a little bit. And they said, your clearance hasn't come through. You're not authorized to look at what you've just designed.
that story has the ring of truth.
And he said he never saw it again. His clearance came through long after the project was already out of his hands and he had nothing to do with it anymore.
That's very familiar to what I've seen in some of the other work I've done.
Well, can you give an example?
Can I give an example?
Yeah.
A similar safe house that it was my introduction to working with the government back in the 1980s in Europe when I was in school over there, that apparently the code breakers that designed the algorithm for breaking a code were not allowed to see the code that they had just created for decrypting a Russian, or at that time Soviet code, that they themselves were busy documenting.
Sounds like an NSA thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's insane, but and that seems to make sense to me. It's like, okay, you've cracked the code, but we're not going to allow you to see what we've cracked because, oh, you said they weren't allowed to even see what they had worked on anymore. It was just taken away from them.
They created to crack the code. That they were not allowed to see the algorithm again.
Oh, I see.
After they had created it. They could see all of the code that they were recording. That, you know, it was a listening station.
Right.
And they would sit there writing, you know, the little symbols down on the little pads, you know, in groups of five. But after they had come up with the algorithm, they supposedly were not supposed to write down or share information about the algorithm again. Even though they were the ones that were transcribing the code.
Right.
That was supposed to be decrypted using the algorithm that they had developed.
I'm sorry to say that makes sense to me because if the more people that know about it, the more people that are talking about it, the more chance it has to get out. I figured that would be the logic behind that, that whatever crazy logic you want to think of, that would make sense.
I understand the logic behind it, but how does someone who develops the algorithm for cracking your code forget
that
algorithm themselves.
I see what you mean.
Do you stick a soldering iron in your ear or something?
We essentially saying we are ordering you to have a faulty memory.
Yeah, literally that's what was going on.
Whether you have one or not, you have a faulty memory now.
Yeah.
We've got 5 minutes left. Is there something that we didn't cover, Matthew, that you wanted to mention, talk about, or indeed ask John, I, or Walter?
Not that I can think of right now. It's been fun.
It has been fun having you on because it's interesting to have somebody on that will come on and say, you know, actually say, I've worked on this. This is, you know, this is a fairly good explanation for what people are seeing. I don't know if it covers all the bases, but to you, you know, from your point of view, it does. And that most people don't know about, and that you have a unique perspective on. So thanks so much for coming on, and to John for turning us on to your expertise.
Oh, well, thank you. You're welcome.
All right.
John, is there anything else you wanted to say before we sign off here and I play a wacky piece of music for everyone?
Yeah, I'm going to say go to darkecho.com/John Shirley, darkecho, DarkEcho Amazon.com/John Shirley, and you'll see a plethora of books by me that you're not even aware of, Greg, apparently. I think you're about 10 years out of date on my publications.
No, well, I have the...
Eight novels that you're, I think you're unaware of,
yeah.
And like Black Glass, and my book on Gurdjieff, a nonfiction book, Gurdjieff, An Introduction to His Life and Ideas. And so anybody who's curious about my stuff can go there. They can find Bleak History and The Other End, the book we were talking about, The Alternative Apocalypse, and my nonfiction book on Gurdjieff and every damn other thing. Or just Google me. John Shirley, like Shirley Temple.
Yes, right. Oh, you know what? One thing people don't know is that John and I both, well, obviously I did, but John had a online and possibly telephone communication with Mac Tonies.
Oh, yeah. I talked to him on the phone and online. I never actually met him, Mac Tonies, but I liked him, and I enjoyed the book, or what came out of the book he was working on. The crypto-terrestrials, and it's just like a fun concept. I think people are going to be stealing from the crypto-terrestrials for TV shows like Fringe.
Oh, of course.
You know, they're going to be ripping off Mac, who died, I guess, of some kind of heart defect, young, not long ago. But
October 19th.
Book of stories, and he was a talented, smart guy.
Yeah, it was weird to me to hear Mac when he was alive saying, "Oh, I just talked to John Shirley." He's like, "I know John. How do you know John?" Very small world.
Well, yes, he was a fan of my books too, but And, you know, he liked the kind of Jacques Vallée, what would you say, paradigm on UFOs. That there was, you know, some kind of an alternate explanation.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
John Keel on acid or something.
Yeah, or John Keel, you know, two generations further, which is exactly what he is and what the book is. John, will you come on the show so we can have a civilized, long-running debate here in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah. At some point, I'm going to come down to L.A., too.
Oh, but if you're here on a Sunday, we can do the show. If not, at least we have to go and hang out, because I haven't seen you in, what, maybe 6 or 7 years?
Yeah, so that'd be great.
All right, John. Matthew, if you're still there, thanks again so much for coming on and talking to us and being patient with us and the low-tech studio we have here.
That's perfectly fine. It was a lot of fun.
All right.
And thank you for having me on.
All right. It's Radio Misterioso. Our guests have been Matthew, no last name used, who works for defense contractors on lighter-than-air craft. And our longtime friend John Shirley, author, screenwriter, musician, band leader, raconteur, and general cool guy. And we will have him on again in the next few weeks. Thanks for listening. And hey, John, do you have a UFO related song that I might have here? Oh, but I don't have any Blue Oyster Cult. Sorry.
Do I what? The latest song?
A UFO related song that I might have on my iPod here.
Well, you don't have E.T. You don't have their extraterrestrial song, huh? I don't know. How about Patti Smith? Got any Patti Smith UFO song?
No, you just told me about that last week, and it looks like to get some of them, I'd have to actually go and buy them at the store, which
oh,
I
yeah,
haven't done.
Half of, you know, half of her album, Horses, was, you know, full of Wilhelm Reich references and all mixed up with Flying Saucer references.
Really?
Yeah,
because you said the Flying Saucer thing. I didn't know that she had a Reich theme going as well.
Yeah, there was this old Wilhelm Reich trip that she was on for a long time, so.
No.
So I don't know. Flying Saucer's Rock and Roll, got that one?
I might have that one. Let me look.
classic from the 50s.
Yeah, I can't remember who did it, but I might even have it.
Flying Saucers Rock and Roll.
Yeah, it's just a basic, you know, blues riff, but they just sing Flying Saucers Rock and Roll over. I don't even think there's any lyrics.
No, there is.
Oh,
there
okay.
is. It's kind of a, yeah, it's actually a rockabilly sort of cut.
Yeah. Flying Saucer and the Tuck Driver, Flying Saucer Boogie, Flying Saucer Safari by the Suburban Lawns, Flying Saucers by Nina Hagen.
That sounds good.
Okay, we'll play that. A couple years ago in Roswell, I spoke there, and Nina Hagen was there.
No kidding.
Yeah, she was there. I guess she has a reality show in Germany, and they're filming a segment for it. And she just happened to be in Roswell, and there was a sort of a party in the hangar where they took whatever they found out there in 1947. And there's this weird woman running around with a shirt that says CIA on it, a T-shirt, and she's got a pink tutu on, and she's got a pound of makeup on. I was like, who the hell is that? And suddenly we find out it's Nina Hagen, and since most of the UFO researchers there in their 60s and 70s, they were like, what, who? My wife and I and a couple other people went, holy shit, it's Nina Hagen! And she gave a little talk, and we went over, and I got a picture with her.
Oh, I'm sure she is. Yeah, I'm gonna Google her and see what she's up to. All right, play Nina Hagen.
All right, I'll play Nina Hagen. Thanks, John, and I will contact you about what day you're free, which Sunday you're free to give over the whole 2 hours to us, just talking about whatever the hell we want to.
All right. See you then.
All right, see ya. Thanks, John. Here's Flying Saucer. Oh, I'm sorry. Walter wanted to... No? Okay.
Attention, here and now. Here and now. Good morning, America. Good morning. Zeitangst.